I'm going to change topic quite a bit. Oops. What happened? C'est quoi ce machin? Forward. Okay. Yes, Pierre asked me to talk to you about jets, outflows, and disk winds in young stars. So we're going from evolved stars to very young stars. Oops. Oof. Voilà. And this is probably a picture that a lot of you have seen, an HST picture, and I like it because it's really striking how you see these naked jets emerging into an H2 region. So this is Mystic Mountain. You know, HST always has these amazing names for their PRs. And at the tip of these pillars, young stars have formed, and they are ejecting, they're producing these jets, and these jets are creating bow shocks when they ram into the ambient medium. And there is another one here. The other side is not as clearly visible. This is a very spectacular manifestation of star formation. Briefly, I'm going to try to be pedagogical and describe the outflow signatures, discuss how we think these are collimated, also the energetics, you know, what is launching these jets, and I'm going to show that it's very hard, we think it's hard to make with stellar winds, so we are considering magnetic processes, but these also seem to have challenges, so right now we still don't really know. A quick reminder about star formation stages. So this is showing the very first stages, which are optically invisible. This is taking place inside of a dark cloud. You have dense cores. This is the physical scale here, 100,000 AUs. Each core is about 10,000 AU, and suddenly it collapses under gravity, becomes unstable. And during this collapse, because it is rotating, you form a star, but you also form a disk around the star that is centrifugally supported. And this disk accretes onto the star to continue, so the star continues to grow. And there is this envelope hiding the star. So we call these protostars because they're still dominated by accretion in terms of luminosity. And we have two different classes. You will see that I'll use class 0 and class 1. Class 0 is when the stellar mass is still less than the envelope mass. So it's the very beginning. Most of the mass is still in the envelope. And class 1 is the late phase where most of the mass has been dumped onto the star, but it's still optically invisible. And then, eventually, the envelope dissipates, clears out, and you're left with a star plus the disk. And that's called the Tittori star stage. So all of these are optically visible with the accretion disk, and we call them class 2 also. It's a way to classify them from the infrared. Then eventually also the disk accretes and disappears and form planets. I mean, we don't really know in which order this happens, but eventually we have a young star without accretion, just some debris and planets. That's class 3. And then the star... outflows only happen during these two stages where we have disk accretion. This is very important. This is something we have verified many, many times. If we look at, for example, these two types of stars, the central star can be exactly the same, but only the ones that have accretion disks produce jets and outflows, and not the others. So it's really a phenomenon linked to accretion. How do we see these outflows? There are two main kinds of signatures. The first one is jets, fast axial jets. This is an HST image of HH34 in H-alpha. And they're pretty fast, hundreds of kilometers per second. And they're seen in a bunch of tracers, atomic or ionic lines. Also free-free radio continuum, because this is ionized gas. Also molecular lines in the youngest of the sources, the protostars, and sometimes water masers at the very base. And then there is a distinct manifestation that is at lower velocity, only a few tenths of kilometers per second. It's much broader, and it looks like cavities. So we call them outflow cavities. This is a Spitzer image in H2, molecular H2. You can still see the jet here in the middle. This is a jet that does have molecules in it. You see the jet here on the other side, but you also see this broad cavity. And these are reviews that, you know, if you want to pursue. So the striking thing, I thought it would be nice to show this here, is the similarity with jets and outflows in other completely different contexts. Like this is the protostar, and this is a supermassive black hole here, M87. And it's really striking to see how similar they look like. For the low velocity cavities, I found this picture, which also looked pretty similar. You can even guess that there is some kind of jet here. I don't know this object at all, of course, but it struck me how similar they looked. So for these low velocity outflow cavities, I'm not going to talk about them too much in the rest of the talk, but it's important to know that these were the first observed outflow signatures in protostars. Because before CCDs were really operational, so in the 1980s, from radio molecular observations in CO, people noticed that there were these lobes of gas, blue shifted on one side, red shifted on the other side, and they noted that the mass of this outflowing gas was larger than the likely stellar mass. So it's mostly ambient gas that's being swept up by something ejected from the star. It's not really the ejection itself. So, and there are two ways to sweep it up. Jet bow shocks, which is something we put forward some time ago. And maybe also some wide-angle wind. Some people argue that you need that to produce the outflow cavities. Well, this is an ALMA, recent ALMA observation of a jet and outflow system. And the jet is in green. And you can also see the tip of the cavity. And in red, you have the CO emission. And you can see that, I don't know if you can see very well, but there are these walls here. Like you have several nested cavities inside another, inside this. So at least in this object, it looks like it's mostly just a series of jet bow shocks that are pushing aside this cavity. But I won't discuss these more. So back to the jets themselves, because that's what we are sure is really, you know, happening and being ejected. These are images of jets in the three accreting phases, the class zero, so the youngest protostars, 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4 years old, the class 1 protostars, 10 times older, 10 to the 5, and the class 2, or Tittori star with accretion disk, a million year, and note how similar they look. Although they look shorter and shorter, this is just because the intensity in the mass flux drops with time, but otherwise they look very similar in collimation, in even the knot spacings are similar, the velocities are similar, it's really striking. What is also striking is that it doesn't seem to depend on the mass of the star. So jets have been observed in young brown dwarfs of 20 Jupiter masses, also in massive protostars of 15 solar masses, accretion rates ranging over 5 orders of magnitude, and notably, it doesn't seem to depend very much on the stellar magnetic field structure, because there are also jets from Herbig AB stars, which are radiative, whereas Tittori stars, low-mass Tittori stars are convective. And this is an example of a jet from a Herbig AB star, so probably 3 solar mass star, and it looks just like a Tittori jet, but it doesn't have, for example, the strong kilo-Gauss dipolar B fields that we see in Tittori stars. So it has to be something that does not rely on a strong photospheric field. Another thing that is striking is that the collimation doesn't depend very much on the also on the phase, the evolutionary stage. So the collimation, this is an optical atomic jet from a Tittori star, so class 2. You see it's very well collimated on large scales. This is the width of the jet versus distance, and it's opening out with a very small angle of 4 degrees. If you look closer with HST, Pat Hartigan looked and managed to resolve the jet width all the way down to a few tenths of AUs. You see the opening angle is larger. So it seems that this thing is being rather broader at the base, and then it is reconfined on these scales of about tenths of AUs. And what is also interesting is that we see the same in class zero protostars. We have looked at a molecular jet here, and this is the measurement. You see it's very similar. And also masers, water masers, closer to the source. They give this this star here, the star symbol. So there is something universal also in the collimation. So first people were thinking that you could collimate the jet using the infalling material, but simulations seem to suggest that it's not going to work. These are simulations for different ratio of the infall rate versus the outflow rate. And of course, the stronger the infall from the envelope, the better you can confine this wind. This is originally an isotropic wind. And you see that when you get to ratios of 50, you can manage to produce this nice jet. But observationally, we observe ratios, I'm going to show that later, but we observe ratios that are more like 10. And so in that case, we don't expect to form jets. So the current idea is that we need some kind of magnetic collimation. And there is we're starting to get some evidence about magnetic collimation, at least in this jet here, which is a very bright jet from a 10 solar mass protostar. It's observed in the centimeter range. Here the emission is centimeter free thermal emission. But in the lobes, there is synchrotron emission, and we think that is coming from shock acceleration of electrons. And they have seen polarization. This is done with the VLA. They saw polarized synchrotron here. And if you assume it's non-relativistic, so if you assume that the polarization is perpendicular to the magnetic field, you get this direction here for the magnetic field, and you see it's aligned with the jet. So, and also, you don't see it here, but the polarization degree increases when you go to the edges of the jet. And that is what you predict if you have a helical magnetic field. And it's observed in AGN jets from, you know, massive black holes in the center of galaxies. And people interpret this as a helical B field confining the jet. So there is only one observation so far like this, but hopefully more of this will be feasible with better instruments. Another interesting thing that is also just starting is observation of a stationary X-ray not very close to the Tituri star digitale. This is the direction of the jet. The jet is going off this way, and you see a spot here that doesn't seem to be moving. It's about a 30 AU from the star, and that's exactly where I showed you the angle, the opening angle, drops to a few degrees. So maybe that is a signature of some kind of recollimation shock. Now the energetics, because we also need to explain how to launch these jets, not just how to collimate them. It turns out that the mass flux is really large. So we know it's linked to accretion. And so the natural thing to look for is what is the ratio? How much of the accretion rate do you redirect into these jets? So this is a compilation of measurements where the disk accretion rates, this is in solar mass, it's in log scale, sorry, it doesn't show here. These are log scale of solar masses per year. So from 10 to the minus 10 to 10 to the minus 4 solar masses per year for the disk accretion rate, and the same here for the ejection, the mass flux in the jet. And you can see that there is a very good correlation over five orders of magnitude, with a typical ratio of 10%. There is large error bars, like at least a factor of 3 in each direction. But if you look at it statistically, the median value is about 10%. So that's pretty large, and if you compute the associated momentum flux, or the force, you find that it's more than 100 times the ratio of L over C. So that's telling you that it's not relatively driven. You have to find something else. The mechanical luminosity is also a large fraction of the accretion luminosity. So this is really challenging for stellar winds. It cannot be radiatively driven, so people have looked into thermally driven stellar winds, like we heard about this morning. If you want to escape from a solar type Tituri star, you need a temperature, a sound speed equal to the escape speed gives you a temperature of several million degrees, which means you would emit strongly in X-rays. And this is not observed. I mean, we see X-rays, but not to the level that is expected. These are typical mass fluxes that you see in winds and jets from young stars. These would be the predicted X-ray emission, and we observe way down. I mean, this is several 10 to 100 times the stellar luminosity is much, much more than what we observe. So that doesn't work. And the other thing, the other idea people had at some point was to look at alphen wave-driven stellar winds. How does that work? The idea is that these, at least the low-mass stars, have kilo-Gauss fields on their surface. They have accretion. These accretion onto the star can disturb the magnetic field, shake it, and produce alphen waves. These alphen waves can transfer momentum to the gas and drive a wind, a cold wind that would not emit in X-rays. So there's been calculations. The first models were made a long time ago in 1980, but there, I think there are very few work after that. And he managed to get reasonable mass fluxes with reasonable parameters. The problem is that the wind mechanical luminosity that you get is only 20% of what you put into the waves. It's not 100% efficient. So if you want to explain what we have seen for the wind mechanical luminosity, we saw it's 1 to 10% of the accretion luminosity. You have to divide by 20%, so you multiply by 5. You find that you need to put 5 to 50% of the accretion power into coherent alphen waves, because this is a very idealized model where they're all in phase and there is no damping, so it's really the best case. So this seems really difficult to make. And then there was another paper where he tried to make specific models for specific T-Tauri stars. And each time the median ratio between the observed and the modeled mass fluxes was 10%. So basically, we conclude that it seems we need something else than stellar winds to make these jets. And the other possibility is to make them come from the disk. So there's been, I'm just giving you an idea of the scales here. This is how we picture a disk from a young star. There is an inner region that has no dust because the dust sublimates inside about 0.2 astronomical units. And so it's just gas. And then there is this dust layer that is capturing the light from the star and heating up, and so it's thicker. And you would have dusty disk winds here. And the most popular model for disk winds is the Blanford and Payne idea that was proposed for black holes originally. It's magnetocentrifugal. So to be pedagogical, I'm going to try to explain a little bit, but very little. The idea is that you have a magnetic field anchored in the disk, and you can extract by twisting this magnetic field due to the rotation it's going to extract angular momentum from the disk, and also it's going to make the gas accrete because it extracts angular momentum. The rest of the gas is going to accrete. And so with this system, you can actually extract most of the accretion power and transfer it to the magnetic field and then transfer it to the matter very efficiently. And you can also collimate because you have a Lorentz force. If you have this B phi term and a current, the Lorentz force can be directed towards the axis. So it's nice because you launch and you collimate at the same time. And the critical parameter here is called the magnetic lever arm parameter, lambda, that I will talk about a lot later. It's the ratio squared of the alphen radius to the launch radius. R0 is the launch radius. Ra, alphen, is the radius where the poloidal speed equals the alphen speed. And this is going to determine both the final velocity that you reach and also the mass flux. And there are two flavors of disk winds that you may have heard about. One is called the X-wind, and it's really more a scenario than a model because it's never been completely computed, but it assumes that everything comes from the inner edge of the disk. So everything comes from this radius. It assumes this value just to get the right velocities that we observe, and it assumes this ratio just to get to extract all the angular momentum that you need to not to spin up the star. And then there is another class that is called D-wind or extended disk winds, where you assume, and it's more in the spirit of Blanford and Payne, that you assume you're launching from a broad range of radii, and in that case, you can actually solve for the mass loading. If you solve for the disk vertical equilibrium, you put a magnetic field, you can actually get the whole structure. And this has been done analytically and also numerically. There are some numerical simulations which show that it can work. A few more details about how it works. The details come from analytical calculations which are done in a self-similar geometry. And this is showing you the streamlines. So what happens basically is that inside the disk, the magnetic field is twisted by the rotation. I don't know if you saw here, but here the magnetic field, the rotation of the disk tries to carry the magnetic field, but it's held at the other end, so it creates a toroidal term. This B phi creates a torque on the matter, and inside the disk, the torque goes to, in the sense of breaking down, spinning down the matter. So in this part here, it's just making the matter accrete actually faster than with usual viscosity. But if you are closer to the surface, eventually at some height, the torque changes sign. So if you see this particle here, when it starts, the blue line here is a magnetic field line. The magnetic field line is anchored here. The matter is loading onto this field line up here at a slightly larger radius. And of course, at that radius, the Keplerian speed in R is less than the Kepler frequency here is less than the Kepler frequency in R naught. So the magnetic field is rotating a bit here, this magnetic field line is rotating a bit faster than the matter. And this is what is plotted here. This is the ratio of omega along the streamline as a function of height. So originally, it's a bit sub-Keplerian, but then it becomes, at some height, it becomes super-Keplerian, and because it's super-Keplerian, then it flies off. So when you make these detailed calculations, you can also see what controls the mass flux, how much mass you can eject, and this depends very much on how much disk heating there is, because that controls how the density varies with height. So it's ultra sensitive. And depending on the mass flux, this is going to determine the magnetic lever arm, because in the end, you want to extract just the right amount of angular momentum to produce accretion. So they balance each other. Well, now, is this really what we're observing? So with these nice models, we've tried to make synthetic predictions of disk winds and what we should observe and compare to observations. And for the collimation, no problem. It works perfectly well. I'm not even showing it because it just works. Another interesting thing is that if we have a broad range of launch radii, you expect to have a range of velocities, and you would expect to have what we call onion-like velocity structure, with faster material on the axis from the inner radii and slower material around. And that's what you observe in a few cases where you can resolve it. But there are other explanations. So this is one case where it seems to work really well, but it's not like, the definite proof. So we've been trying to get other hints of whether it could be a disk wind, for example, looking for dust. And this is a graph showing the ratio. We try to measure the calcium abundance in the gas phase using line ratios. So we have lines of different atoms, and we compare refractory elements like these to less refractory elements that are supposed not to be depleted, and we compare to what you expect given the temperature of the gas and the density and so on. And the ratio here you can see ranges from a few percent to 10%, but it's never solar. So this suggests that there is missing calcium in the jet. But where is it? So if it's in dust grains, it implies that the jet is launched from outside of the dust sublimation radius, because it means it's trapped in dust grains. And this is about 0.2 AU. So that would be at least an interesting result. But we're not sure that dust grains, it could also be that the dust grains stay trapped in the disk at some distance and never go inside some radius. So even if you launch from inside of the sublimation radius, maybe you would still see this depletion if the dust grains, if the gas that filters in is already depleted. There is another very important test that people got excited about, which is jet rotation. Because this is a magnetocentrifugal mechanism and because the disk winds are extracting the angular momentum for accretion, you expect them to be rotating. The angular momentum is being extracted. And in fact, you are extracting the angular momentum that you extract is the angular momentum at the base in the disk times this lambda parameter. So if you have a lambda of 10, for example, you end up with 10 times the specific angular momentum you had in the disk. And you can measure, you can estimate the launch radius in this case because you have a relationship between the angular momentum, Rv phi, and the poloidal velocity that you reach in the end. And there were there has been several observations with Hubble of things that could be rotation in jets. So when you compare, what do? You make long slit spectra either in this direction or that direction, and you compare the two sides of the jet. And if there is rotation, you will have a slight difference in the Doppler shift on each side because one side of the jet will have an extra component of velocity towards you and the other side will have another component away from you. And so these observations seem to fit very well predictions for disk winds. The problem is that now, very recently, well, in the last few years, we have found several cases where the jet rotation and the disk rotation sense do not match. So pretty much now the statistics are that in half of the cases, they don't match, which means it's like random results and it doesn't match the expectations from steady disk winds. So either they're not steady, they're not rotating. Anyway, it seems that we cannot really use this as a tracer of the launch radius. Il faut que je me dépêche. Last thing that we've been trying to pin down the origin of these jets is to use the molecular tracers. Because a lot in the protostellar stage, they have molecular counterparts. Class zero, many molecules. In class one, only H2. This is an example of a class zero. In green is H2, red is 12CO, and you see that this jet has both H2 molecules and CO molecules in it. So we have to explain where these molecules come from, and the most obvious thing would be to say they're ejected from the disk, because the disks are molecular. When you get closer to the star, the molecules are destroyed. So does it work? And so we did some calculations of the thermochemistry in dusty MHD disk winds, and we found that, yes, they could be molecular, they could agree with these trends. They could also reproduce the line profiles that are observed by Herschel in water. All the protostars have these very broad wings in water lines that people don't know how to explain. And you see the model is the red curve. The observation is the black curve. It seems to work really well with disk winds. So we are very happy. And now we have these new observations that are really challenging because, and I'm going to finish with that. This is an example of, again, HH212, but with ALMA, zooming in on the origin of the jet. And there is, I don't know if you can see, but there is this blue thing here that is a molecular jet that could be a disk wind, but when we look at it closely, it doesn't rotate much. So this is really pointing to low lever arms. This is a summary of other molecular winds that we have been observed with different telescopes, VLBA, Plateau de Bure, ALMA, and in all cases, they rotate rather slowly. And this is always pointing to actually rather low lever arms. So we're not sure if it's really disk winds or if we're just looking at untrained gas. Okay, so what's the last thing I'll mention is that if it's not disk winds, another possibility is magnetospheric ejections. So something that happens in the magnetosphere of the star. And there has been suggestions to use that to launch winds. The problem, and they also have problems. I mean, this one seems to be too slow from the simulations. This one here, where you have a different configuration, puts a lot of B field in the star, so maybe it's not it cannot work for a long time. I'm not going to discuss it too long, and you can ask me more questions if you want. So I put up the conclusions here, and maybe I'll stop here.
Okay, for thank you very much, Sinbi. So we still have time for maybe two short burning questions.
Yeah, it's quite interesting that you show the very striking comparison between the one of the Hubble Haro object and also the rotten egg. But what I think is probably the two are very different, because for a young stellar object to drive the outflow using this magnetocentrifugal models, you need very strong magnetic field. But for the for the case of rotten egg, the companion is only a kind of a main sequence star. So do you have any comments on how we can derive a strong wind from without a strong
no
magnetic
idea.
Field?
I just put it up to spur discussion because I thought it was striking, but no, I have no
yes.
idea.
Another question? Yes, please.
Just a question, maybe technical, but how do you compute the temperature distribution? Is it a constant or...?
When we do the line profiles?
Yes, and for the modeling in general.
For the modeling in general?
Oh, yeah.
In these winds, the main heating term is ambipolar diffusion, in fact.
Okay.
So we do that self-consistently.
Okay.
We actually solve for the whole, the ionization and the temperature are coupled, so we solve both of them together.
Okay, the last question.
Is the rotation of the star thought to play a role in these launching mechanisms?
Is the
rotation of the
star? Oh, the rotation of the star. That's a very good question. So, I didn't mention it so far because I thought I had too much to say. But the funny thing is that also the Tittori stars that drive these jets are not rotating very fast. In general, they are only rotating 10% of breakup. We don't know for the protostars because we cannot observe the protostar itself. What is sure is that we need to break down the star anyway to explain why it's rotating so slowly. So there are some people who have, I don't have it here, some people have claimed that it's a stellar wind for that reason, because you need to break down the star. And so if you had a stellar wind, you could spin down the star and produce a jet. The problem is, I showed you, is how to power such a stellar wind. It's really problematic. So this phenomenon here, unsteady magnetospheric ejections, actually I like quite a lot, because it would use the rotation energy of the star. What happens is there is a twist between the star and the disk rotation, they're not exactly matched. And so this could trigger these reconnections. So in this, we still have to look for a correlation. This is a project we are having now with a student who's working with Corot data, where we have periods for a lot of stars, and we're trying to look for a correlation with a stellar period.
Okay, so we will break now, and we will be back at 3:00. Okay, let's thank Sinbi again.